Welcome back. We had a great module from Edward, and Ross is joining us again for another module here. We want to talk about source control and collaboration. And to start off, we're going to talk a little bit about kind of the fundamentals, because if you're an ops person, you maybe haven't heard about different kinds of version control, or if maybe even if you're a developer, you've really focused on the one particular version control method, and you haven't really dug in deep into all the different things and how this relates. So first off, we'll talk a little bit about centralized version control, one high-level bucket of what version control is. So in this model, right, somebody goes in and checks out a particular piece of source code. Once that piece of source code is checked out, it's now locked. Nobody else can edit that piece of source code, and other folks will have to wait until that is unlocked. When things come to happen as far as merging goes, right, those things, it doesn't really work in that way typically, right? You're going to have somebody checking in, and then somebody else's turn is next, right? And so merging is not as big of a typical concern, because there is not this concept of offline as much of merging code back into the same location. When we talk about distributed version control, this is kind of the other major bucket that we have here. There's history that's involved there, and these machines can edit that source code control on their local machines, and then merge those with various other ones here. This is an example where we have a trifecta where there's three different machines. As you'll see here in a little bit, there's a lot of different ways where things can synchronize and merge up into a centralized code base. But conceptually, these are two major camps of version control of how do we deal with our source code control. When you look at the specifics, what are the two types of source code control, like with what are specific implementations of them? These are some common ones. There's certainly not a comprehensive list here, but in the distributed camp, you have most commonly Git is what a lot of people are familiar with. Mercurial and Bazaar are two other ones that are in the distributed bucket. In the centralized version, you've got what Microsoft usually is, most people in Microsoft are familiar with is TFS, or TFVC as some people call it. So what are the differences more specifically here between these two types of version control? Well, this gives a breakdown list. I'm not going to read through this whole thing here. The big point to think about here is, you know, do what is right for your own business. Now, we certainly see a lot of folks moving, I would say, more and more to a distributed source code system, specifically Git. I think is becoming a lot more common and popular. But there is not necessarily a this is the thing you must do for source code control. And Microsoft has ways to integrate with Team Foundation Server, or TFVC, and Git in a lot of different ways. Throughout the rest of the day today, we're really going to be focused on Git primarily. So just keep that in mind. When we get into a Git model where you have distributed version control, if you go to this slide here, you can see that there's this concept of branching. And with branching, you have a main branch, let's call it, and then any number of other sub-branches. And there's all kinds of things here on branching strategies, well beyond the scope of what we have to discuss today. But at a high level, Microsoft supports Git in a number of different locations. Team Foundation Version Control with TFS. TFS supports it, as well as Visual Studio Online. And, you know, determining your branching strategy is really something that you're going to have to determine in your own organization. But the idea is that these different branches people can check in source code to, and then there's different ways that those source codes can merge up. For instance, there's different workflows that you could see here. One is the common centralized workflow where you have a shared repository and everybody just kind of writes to that single location. That's a pretty basic one, but you can see here that there's a lot of different ways for collaboration communication that can get really interesting. Another one is called this integration manager workflow. And in this one, right, you have developers committing to something public, and then this person that is, let's call them the integration manager, is taking and pulling from all those public repros and kind of putting them back into this sanitized blessed repository, which goes in this kind of cycle, right? So you go from developer private to public to the integration manager, back to the blessed repository, and then all the way back down to private. So it's this circular kind of thing. The point is to not get into, you know, what is the right way to do it here, but just to illustrate the fact that for collaboration and communication, there's a lot of different ways that you can do this. One other one that we see that's out there is dictator and lieutenant's workflow. And this is a good term. This is a good one to illustrate the fact that there's a lot of different structures here in collaboration communication. Because in this case, right, you've got somebody that's an intermediary layer that's kind of also helping to facilitate and approve things up into this central, you know, blessed type repository.
I think these last few slides really illustrate what we were talking about earlier on about tools don't solve the problem. It's the processes that solve the problem, and you've got to pick the right process that fits your organizational culture. And these tools are deliberately designed to be flexible, which is why when we were talking about putting them in particular boxes on the diagram earlier, it can be very difficult because they're supposed to be flexible. They're supposed to enable you to adopt the process that fits you, and hence some we could go on all day about the different workflows you could use.
Yeah, so this is to kind of snap back to help us snap back to the collaboration challenges that can arise when you're using source code control, and what do you, you know, what does this introduce when you do things in a kind of isolated type way with source code control. So for that, I want to snap over to Ross here, and he's going to give us a demo of kind of what this might look like.
Yeah, and specifically, I'm going to want to look at what it looks like to a new developer. Let's say, you know, Jane's a new developer with the company. The development team are using a version control system, so it's easy for her to get to the history of the code and to work with the code. But she's got to get her machine set up on the first day. And we're going to assume that we're going to work in a virtual machine environment. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the command line here to talk to Azure. We saw earlier on how you could stand up an image from VM Depot. Edward showed us that earlier. I'm just going to look at a different approach, which is using the command line. And what I'm going to do is look at the virtual machines that I've got up running. I should actually be looking at the images rather than the virtual machines. So let me restart that process. I'm going to look at the images that we've got available to stand up. And ideally, we would have a pre-configured virtual machine that was configured for our developers. But actually, in reality, you know, these are binary blobs. There's so many different things available to us. They come out, they get out of date. And there's no way of storing that, or there often is no way of storing that information in version control. So what we have to do is we say, well, okay, I can't understand which of those we want, but I do know that I want to build on an Ubuntu machine because I happen to like Ubuntu. And I want 14.04. So I'm going to filter that list down to, I don't have grep installed. I'm using a DOS prompt. There's no grep. But that would allow me to look at that particular list of the ones that were just Ubuntu, which is great. And once I've found the right ID, so you see in the list above, there's IDs for images being returned. Once I've found the right ID, which I conveniently had in my history here, I'm able to stand up a virtual machine on Azure. And so what this is doing is pulling the image down. So that's great, but this is just a basic VM. It's just an Ubuntu VM. So we're not going to watch that deploy.
So can I take a quick pause here to just kind of recap something here? So you just snapped right into this prompt, right?
Right.
And you started saying Azure VM command. So
right.
Explain to me what is that? What tool set is that?
So that's a good point.
Yeah.
So that's the Azure command line tools. So in this case, it's the cross-platform command line tools. And what that enables us to do is query our Azure accounts. What images do we have available? What virtual machines do we have up and running? Create new virtual machines, configure those machines, configure storage accounts, et cetera, et cetera. So the point I was trying to get across there is that it doesn't matter if you're using version control. The first thing you've got to do is stand up a virtual machine for our new developer, Jane, to work on. And so that's what I was doing there, standing up a virtual machine and in Azure. It's just a base Ubuntu machine because that's what Jane happens to want to work, but it could well have been any other distribution, Windows or any other distribution of Linux that, that's available on there.
Yeah, and those cross-plat CLI tools, right, those can be installed on a Linux machine.
So, absolutely.
So if you wanted from an Ubuntu VM and spin up Azure infrastructure, then the cross-plat CLI would help you.
Absolutely. Yeah. So by cross-platform, it's written in Node.js and therefore will run anywhere where Node.js will run. There's also PowerShell CLIs, but obviously they're limited to the Windows platform. Okay. So once we've got the virtual machine up, we can log into it. And you can see that I've logged into a machine here. It's an Ubuntu machine, just like the one that we're standing up in the background there. And now I need to actually configure this. The first thing I need to do is check out the from Git, because that's what we're using. But hey, Ubuntu doesn't have Git installed. Okay, so straight away, I've got to start getting into apt-get. We need to update first. And this will take a few moments to update the repositories so that I can start configuring the machine. And I'm going to spend a few minutes doing this. In total time, it's going to take me about 10 to 15 minutes. And that's with practice, knowing precisely what I'm doing, and knowing exactly what versions of the software I want, etc. In real time, in what you're watching, we'll condense it down so that you don't have to sit here watching the command line go by for 10 minutes. So once I've updated, I need to install Git. So apt-get install Git. And this will take a few moments to install. And by the end of this whole process, where we're going to be at is that we will actually have the version control system on our local machine and we'll be able to build our very simple application. So I now have Git, but my application is written in Node and I don't have Node on my machine at the moment. So now I have to install Node. Now I could script all this and run that script automatically every time I stand up a new machine. And that's great, but I said earlier that Jane happens to want to use Ubuntu in this case, but what if Joe wants to use a different operating system? What if he wants to use Windows? What if he wants to use a Core OS or whatever? So the story goes on. I now have Node, I now have to install NPM, which is a Node package manager. Okay. So that's now run, and I now have Node on my machine. So before I had no Node command, now I do. I've gone into the Node command prompt there. So I can now check out, or clone as is a correct terminology, the source code. So we're beginning to get to the point now of being able to start work. And this has taken time already, and as I said, it would be more complex and therefore more error-prone if we were doing this with a real development environment. So what I'm doing here is I'm cloning the repository. This is happening to come from Visual Studio Online, but that's irrelevant. It could come from any Git repository. And I now have the source code for this simple application on my machine. Okay, so there's a simple application. Let's take a very quick look at it so we know what to expect. So if we go to the one source file that is in here, it's a very simple Node application. All we're doing is we're saying if we request the root URL from this web service, we'll return some simple text. Of course, this is horrible hacky code. We're not returning proper well-formed text or anything, just text, so don't write your code this way, folks. But it works for demonstration purposes. If we request VM images, then we're returning a JSON a file, which is hard-coded into our application here. And if we request VM image, then we're returning a different JSON file, in this case describing an actual image. So it's all hard-coded, it's very simple, there's no real communication with other services or et cetera, but it's sufficient for us to see what's happening. So now we've configured this machine, we can run the system. I know why that is. I haven't done, I need to do sudo npm install. Whoops, mistyped that too. Sudo npm install, and what this is going to do is going to pull down any application dependencies. So what we've just done is manually configured this machine so that we can work with it. Because we're using version control, we're able to store the application dependencies in version control itself, and that enables the developer, once they have a machine up and running, to get moving very, very quickly. So you can just run sudo npm install, which appears not to be running for us for at the moment. I'll have a look at that in a moment. But once it's configured, then we're able to compile the application or run the application, as is the case here, and start locally. So rather than debug this live, we'll move forwards and start looking at the problems that this approach takes. So David, what are the problems that we have here in terms of configuring the machine?
Yeah, so I mean, you've done so far a lot of things that I would say is kind of, if we stop there, where maybe some organizations are or kind of a old school way or a non-DevOps way of doing things, meaning like developer goes and does a bunch of stuff. And I think about the things that I think about as an ops guy is that developers say, it works on my machine, right? As you can see.
just like that.
Yeah, as you can see with Ross here, right? You know, there's even like, hey, there's certain things. Oh, yeah, I forgot to install this package thing, right? And then all of a sudden, these little tweaks that developers and other people do becomes an issue when you try and move that same configuration to different environments, right, for your application. But needless to be say, kind of tying that back to collaboration, this highlights the importance of having not only a structure here for version control of, you know, what you're doing for your code itself, but also, right, you need something for defining the infrastructure itself, which is what we'll talk about later. You know, because there's so many different things that could or variations that could happen here, and you really need to have things consistent across all of your environments. So if we kind of recap here.
Yeah, well, to show the end of that, I managed to make it work on my machine. So now everybody else could do it. What I've done whilst David was talking was run that npm install, so you can see all the dependencies have been installed for us. Then I ran the server in a separate process. It started listening on port 8080, so I can now connect to that application. And I'm up and running. We can see it returns the information that we talked about earlier on. So the point here is, as David says, works on my machine is the real problem. If I haven't got it quite configured correctly, which is the case that we saw there, then it won't work. Now, I happen to have rehearsed this a number of times, and so I was able to fix the problem quickly. But for the real Jane, you know, right, she's lost.
Right. Well, and also, right, I mean, as you do the handoffs between, let's say, if you have a separate test environment or QA folks, right, if you are then going into production, you probably are going to need to change certain variables or tweak certain things, right? There's a lot of challenges that are all introduced by just saying, oh, version control is enough, you know, and that's it, right, for just the app itself, you know, so.
Yeah. So we're going to be following this out
throughout the day. We'll see how we kind of unravel these problems. So just to kind of, you know, recap here on the slide, and then we'll close out. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do source code repos. It is a foundation for things, but you need more than just a source code repo to effectively communicate. You need version control for your infrastructure as well as the app itself. Okay, one other thing I want to make sure you're aware of is there are a ton of different resources on Git in particular and version control. You can look at this list of resources. The other thing I want to also stress is Microsoft is also committed to open source. If you go to these GitHub repositories from the MS OpenTech team, from Microsoft, and from the Azure teams, you're starting to see more and more software that's open source being committed up to GitHub. So just a big thing for you to go and check out. Okay, we are continuing on with a very important concept called, in this module, reproducible environments. Now with reproducible environments, there's a lot of different things that are involved under this hood, but one of the most important things is infrastructure and configuration as code. This is extremely important. It is the foundation, I would say, for so many other things within DevOps, the DevOps world. If you don't have this down, a lot of other things beyond this become really challenging to do. But what is it? Well, you're probably going to have a developer and our operations collaborate or be aware, at least agree upon this common definition of some form of code. This can be a lot of different things, as you'll see later. That code will then go out and provision and define the underlying infrastructure. Now, when you do this in a cloud system, the cloud typically makes this much easier to do. You could do this, though, with on-premises type infrastructure as well. But when you do that, right, that code provisions that infrastructure in a way that you could define it, check it into source code control. You could also set up that code to provision the application on top of it. So you have a fully automated way to define what that environment looks like, and it's identical or with maybe slight modifications across these different environments. Why might you do this, though? Well, you might do this for a lot of different reasons. It's going to help you optimize your resources, right? If you've got a common standard definition for how that is defined, you've now can say, instead of thinking about, well, how much capacity planning and hardware do I want to have? If you provision that in the cloud, you could, let's say, it takes me, I don't know, 5 minutes, an hour to provision an infrastructure for a test environment. I now could start thinking a little bit differently, right? I could say, well, why don't I just tear down that cloud infrastructure and save all that cost for however many hours, since I'm paying by the minute or by the hour, and then spin it up tomorrow when the developer needs to start doing that testing. You're also going to accelerate delivery, right? Because you're no longer waiting for any of these steps to say we have to wait a while to provision a new physical server or hardware, or wait through X number of things that are there to manually deploy a dock or something like that. It's now up and it's available, right? That's going to naturally increase your flow of delivery in your system. How might you measure this? Well, it could be a number of different things. Mean time to resolution, because it's quicker to, let's say, roll forward or roll back from things when it's all defined as code. You also are going to have naturally a change rate or a deployment rate that you can measure and say, we've deployed 50 changes into production this week. So these are kind of, the major things here around this core DevOps principle. There is another thing, though, that we need to talk about, and this is really important. This is the only time in the course of the day that we're going to get a chance to really talk about this perspective, and that is architecture. Okay, so there are before we get into all the different ways that you could create this infrastructure as code, you really, as a company or as an organization, you need to make this decision on what is it that my app I want it to look like at a high layer. Now, a lot of the stuff and a lot of the focus on the DevOps tools that we'll likely cover here the rest of the day is on the Azure VM side or the IaaS side, right? Focused on the VMs itself. And the VMs are great because you have a lot of control, right? You can control everything in that host OS, and you get a lot of control in being able to do that, but it also comes a little bit at a cost, right, when you use infrastructure as a service. Because when you go to, let's say, do things like scale, well, you've got this whole host OS that you now have to reproduce and recreate in your environment. That takes time. That takes some overhead to make that happen. It is great because it also enables you to have all kinds of agent plugins like Puppet, Chef, or DSC, which are designed to do configuration of that underlying host OS. There are other things, though, that you might want to do. So if you look at the next one in the list, which is containers or platform as a service, you're now starting to abstract that host OS from the actual running application. And with this here, it's going to really enable more portability. It's also going to enable the better ability to, let's say, put more workloads and more things on top of that underlying host OS. But it also still comes with a little bit of challenges, and we'll talk more about this in a little bit later. But you're also still running a host OS that you have to manage and maintain on top of that. All of these have trade-offs. I'm not trying to sway you one way or another. It is just something you really need to consider before you move forward, because the tools you're going to use will really vary. The last two on the list are Microsoft's custom platform as a service offerings that we have. One is Azure Cloud Services. So earlier in the course, you noticed I brought up cloud services, cloudapp.net. Now, that can be a public DNS endpoint to access things, but it also can be, a cloud service can also mean this platform as a service offering where you just define the code. It runs, .NET or Java or, some of our other languages that you can write this app in. You are totally and completely abstracted from the underlying operating system. So when I say that, it's really important to point that out because, without getting too specific, I've seen recent announcements from some of our competition out there, and they start talking about how we have this new service, this new thing that does like helps you with auto scaling and provisioning and release management pipeline and things like that. Well, these challenges that you have if you're running VMs, they start to really go away and they become much easier when you have either one of like our platform as a service cloud offerings. For instance, you want to scale a website or a cloud service up to 10 more instances, 50, 100, click a button, it's like seconds, done. You don't have to really do anything else, right? These are the types of advantages you get when you completely abstract your app from having to care about the underlying host OS, right? You don't need to have a Chef or DSC agent because you don't care about that. The Azure platform actually takes care of that for you, right? If the underlying host OS needs to be updated, you don't have to really worry about that as so much because your app is abstracted from that. That's all taken care of that for you. So with that though, if we go back to the slide, I want to highlight a couple other things, right? There is a slight trade-off with that though, because you know you do lose some control because although you can run, like let's say with Azure Cloud Services startup tasks, and with Azure websites, you can do custom plugins and things like that, you are still kind of limited to the scope of the amount of customizations and tweaks that you can do. With Azure websites, right, there are a lot of really cool things like you can do that's testing and production. So, and you know, testing and production makes it super easy for you to be able to, let's say, spin up 2% of your traffic to one of your Azure websites. Literally a few clicks of a button and you've enabled that functionality. That's pretty powerful, and that's something that takes quite a bit more work and effort to make happen if you're going all the way back to, let's say, a virtual machine. So again, I mean, I have my own take, my own preferences, and again, I'm not saying you need to do one or the other, but depending upon your decision as a company, what you want to do, you know, it is going to impact what kind of tools and things you can utilize. Okay, so I think I beat that one up pretty good, but it is a really important one because that's the only time we're going to cover it. So this is kind of the next slide. It talks about, you know, to kind of flush that concept out a little bit more, which is how might I automate or create infrastructure as code scripts based on which particular Azure services I want to utilize. So this is a kind of a overwhelming list because it's a huge matrix that we have here. But at the top layer here, you've got PowerShell, Crossplat CLI, which we've covered earlier today and talked about, right? And people have utilized that to provision, right, the virtual machines. We also have Microsoft Azure Markup Language. We have the REST API. We also have on the right-hand side, Chef, Puppet, and Vagrant. These have plugins to enable you to directly provision these different types of Azure resources. So you notice, like virtual machines, basic storage, and things like that, those are things that Chef, Puppet, and naturally have a connection to because that's what they require to be able to run their agent and do things, right? So, but if you wanted to, let's say, do something like with an Azure website, you'd probably need to use a different type of tool to create your infrastructure as a code, like PowerShell or, you know, one of these other mechanisms to be able to have a script that provisions all those things. And again, I also point out that this is not a comprehensive list of all of the Azure services that we have. Last time I remember, there was like around 70 Azure services that are up there that keeps growing. But this is just to give you a thought process of what you need to do or think about in how am I going to create this infrastructure as code based upon the app architecture and what I want to accomplish in my organization. Okay. So, that being said, let's dive into open source software tools. Open source software tools that help with this infrastructure as code and creating reproducible environments. If you go to this list here, there's quite a number of things that are relevant. Chef and Puppet we're going to actually cover later in the day, but you very well could, as you saw on the previous slide, use Chef and Puppet to create infrastructure as code scripts that provision Azure infrastructure. But the focus of the rest of this module, we're going to talk about Vagrant and Docker and how you might use those to create reproducible environments that are based on a virtual machine and or containerization architecture. So Docker on Azure. All right. This is we've had a lot of announcements around Docker and Azure lately.
It's been a busy time.
But let's you know, there's still a lot of confusion on what is Docker, how does it work, you know, what are all the things we're talking about. So right now we want to give you kind of a foundation of what is Docker, and we'll go from there. So if we go to the slide, you can see that the way this works is at the bottom layer here. One of the things we announced recently is that on top of the vNext version of Windows Server, we are going to enable Docker, the engine, as it's listed here, Docker Engine Daemon, to run on top of that. Now, once you run that Docker Daemon engine, you've now got the ability to run the Docker client images or containers on top of that. Effectively, you're through Docker, the Docker EXE and the underlying remote API, you're now abstracting the host OS, hence platform as a service, from whatever that application is that's running. That same container could be utilized on a Windows server or a Linux server. Depends on, of course, what underlying dependencies you have there.
Let me jump in there. That's not quite right.
Yeah.
So a Linux container will only run on a Linux operating system. Right. And a Windows container, when they're made available in vNext, will only run on a Windows operating system.
Okay.
So they're not portable across different operating systems. And that's because the containers use the underlying operating system quite heavily. It's not like a VM where they bring a whole operating system with them. What we're doing with the Docker clients, which was on that slide there, is we're enabling it that you can manage those containers from either platform. So you can run the Docker client on Windows and manage Linux and Windows containers, or you can do it the other way around, or any combination you want. And then, as you said, David, that the Docker engine is also coming to Windows Server vNext. It's not available yet.
Yeah, thank you. It's very, right, I mean, because you're going to have all those underlying dependencies on the operating system underneath, it's not practical to do swapping of the container between the underlying Linux or Windows Server, right? It just doesn't really make sense. So what is the difference, though, between a container and a virtual machine? Let's take that kind of analysis here, because it's still something that I think it's important to wrap your head around. You know, on the left-hand side, we've got our traditional VM. So, you know, we abstract at the server layer, you've got the host OS and you've got a hypervisor. In our case, right, it's for Microsoft, it's Hyper-V. Hyper-V then enables you to run guest operating systems on top of that. That guest OS then contains the full stack, right, the app and whatever else you want with it, but you manage that guest OS inside of that virtual machine. When you switch over to containers, you've now got another additional layer of abstraction to where your app, or your, in this case, it's going to be a container, right? It's going to have the app, the number of dependencies. That container is going to have the full running functionality that you want to have accomplished. So now that container does have potential dependencies on whatever the underlying host OS is, but that container has portability. If you have a similar, let's say, host OS on somewhere else, you could now move that container between those host OSs, which have the same underlying base configuration.
Right.
So you've abstracted, you know, that host OS from the app itself and its dependencies. So there, that's kind of a high level difference of VMs and containers. So what is Microsoft and Docker doing, other than we kind of mentioned the earlier slide? What are some of the things that we have there? You know, right, there's a number of articles which you've written, and maybe you want to talk to these two slides
here.
Because you've got your articles.
Remember what was said.
Yeah.
So the one that's there, that was our first announcement around Docker. When Docker went version 1.0, which was back in June, we were there at the same conference announcing Docker coming to Azure. So what we did with the command line tools that we've seen earlier, we provided a command in there. So where earlier we did Azure VM create, you can now do Azure VM create Docker. And what that does is create a Docker host. It fires up a VM just like normal, and it installs Docker on that VM for you. And the beauty of this is it makes it really, really easy to get started. The next version of that, assuming that the community accept the proposal, there's a community proposal at the moment that will bring that functionality into Docker client itself. So you'll no longer need the cross-platform tools, you'll just need the Docker client. And then the next announcement that if you're following on the deck is just another one on that slide, is the announcement we made a few days ago which is what we've already talked about. It's that we're bringing the Docker client to Windows, and in fact that's working very well. Just this past weekend, or very recently at least, we had the first pull request accepted into core for building and using the Docker client on Windows, so that's progressing very well. We are bringing the Docker Hub, which is a place where you can pull images from, and we'll see that in the demo shortly, to Azure, so that if you're on Azure, everything will happen very quickly for you. We're collaborating on the Open Orchestration APIs, and these are the APIs that you'll use for managing containers that are running and deploying and so on. And by collaborating on those and making sure that Windows Server vNext uses those same APIs for container management, means that you can use any client that uses those same APIs. So you can use whatever tooling is available as we move forward, as well as the Docker client. And then the final item has slipped my memory, so there's something.
So that's fine. So definitely, yeah. So there is. If we go back to the slide real quick, I want to call out one link that's at the bottom there, which is there's a Docker and Microsoft breakout session at TechEd Europe, which was done by Corey Sanders, and it's a really great session. Yeah. 75 minutes of just covering Docker and Microsoft, and going into more depth than we have time to today here on this module. But definitely check that out and check out the articles that we link there. But if it comes, when it comes back to it, right, we want to also at Microsoft give you choice. So if you go to this slide here, the beauty of one of the great things about Docker is you have this ability, right, to take a container and run it on, again, that kind of Cloud OS concept that we have, is the vision that we have of running it on Microsoft Azure Service Provider Customer Data Center, and having that flexibility and that choice.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So with that, I think, I would love to switch to you, Ross, and show me Docker. What does it look
right.
like? We've got lots of slides,
Okay, so let's have a look at Docker in action then. So the machine that I'm on here, it's the same machine that we were working on earlier on. It's exactly the same setup. And what I need to do now is I need to install Docker, because we're going to use Docker. Now, we could look at this as being another step in having to set our machine up, another thing that could go wrong, but I'll show you why that's not necessarily the case during the course of this demo. So on the screen here, I've pre-prepared so I don't mistype, but we're going to pull using curl. This is a bash shell, so what curl does is it pulls the resource from the address that's provided there, and in this case, it's the install script for Ubuntu, and this is provided by Docker themselves. So they maintain that. And I'm going to pipe it into a shell, which will just execute it. So whilst that's executing, the reason I say that this isn't another overhead on configuring the machine is, A, we don't have to maintain that script. B, the Docker community are maintaining similar scripts for most platforms. And C, it's the same configuration regardless of what tooling and application you're going to put on there afterwards. So there's no really big learning curve. There's nothing for us to manage internally. All we have to do is put that command into our machine, and Docker will automagically appear for us. And that's precisely what's happening here on the screen at the moment. So once that's installed, what I'm going to do is show you Docker running. So the first thing I'm going to do is build a Docker container. But actually, before I do that, let's have a look at how we define a Docker container. So here we are this is the same machine, it's just a different SSH connection to it. Same machine. This file is called the Docker file. And the first thing that we do in a Docker file, which is this first line where the cursor is we say from node. Now, I mentioned the Docker Hub earlier. What this line is saying from the Docker Hub, bring me an image called node. Now, that image is an image that's maintained by somebody else, and it has all of the configuration on it that we did earlier. All those pain points, the things that went wrong for me despite all the rehearsal and preparation, it's all done for me. All I have to do is say from node, and I will get a container which has all of that configuration built on it for me. In this case, I'm using a community-provided container, but it could be anybody. It could be us that had provided that. Next up, we're saying the current directory should be mapped into the container, copied into the container, in fact, under the directory user server. We're going to use that as our work directory. We're going to run npm install. Now, this was a step that we had to do. If you recall, I actually forgot to run it and thought, oh, why is it not working? Well, I can't forget anymore because it's going to happen for me automatically. Then I'm going to, in this container, I'm going to expose port 8080. So the container is going to talk to the outside world via port 8080. And then finally, when I run this container, I'm going to run this command. I'm going to run node and then source server JS. And again, if you were following earlier, you'll see that was the command that I typed in at the command prompt. Okay, so Docker's installed. So now I can actually build a container by saying sudo docker build. I need to give the container a name. Actually, it's optional, but it's very much advised. And I need to say the Docker file that you need to describe this is in this folder. So I'll hit return there. And this first time that you do this, it takes a little while, because what's happening is we're executing the from node line at the moment. And what it's doing is it's gone off to the Docker hub, and it says, have you got a container called node? Yes, I have. Well, here it is. And it's actually multiple layers. I'm not going to go into detail as to why there's multiple layers there. It's a very powerful feature of Docker that enables kind of version controlling of your images. But it's something that Corey does talk about in his presentation, I believe, at TechEd. So we're going to go on and we're going to download the rest of these images. And once they've downloaded, then we're going to configure it with the rest of the information in our Docker file that we just looked at. Now, I mentioned Docker Hub was going to be brought to Azure, so it's going to be mirrored on Azure. These downloads will be a lot faster because, of course, you'll be in the same data centers. You also won't be charged for egress on your Azure account doing this kind of thing because it'll be within the data center, et cetera. So some huge benefits coming down the line there. The other thing about this is as well, is once I've pulled these images down, remember this was a fresh VM, so this is the first time it's ever happened on this machine. Once I have got them, they'll be cached locally. So this step will be very quick. It'll just be, is there an updated version of this container? No, there isn't. Okay, get on with it then. Okay, so this is actually taking a little while, as is always the case. So whilst that's downloading, let me talk a little bit about the next steps so that I can go quicker when it's come down. So when this is finished, I'm going to run the container. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to say I want to map a port on my host machine to port 8080. And then because that container is running the server in the way that we looked at earlier on, I'm going to be able to connect to it using the curl command just as I did earlier on. Now that startup time is going to be almost instantaneous. None of this long waiting for the VM to start and for the operating system to start up, etc. It's going to be very, very quick. And in fact, I'm going to demonstrate how quick it is by starting up maybe 10 containers all on this same machine. I'm noticing my time's going up, so I'll keep talking and go ahead of myself and then come back and look at this later. So when I start up all of those multiple machines, although this is a very simple application, consider a real application in the real world. So you'll have database servers, you'll have wet REST interfaces, you'll have user interfaces, you'll have monitoring systems, you'll have messaging queues, you'll have all sorts of different components in this large application. And as a developer, I'm unlikely to be able to run enough VMs on my machine to be able to stand up that whole infrastructure and simulate the whole environment on my development machine. In containers, I can do that because they're all so lightweight that it's very quick and easy for me to do it. And you will see I'll be running a number of these containers later. Okay, so my image has come down now. So we're now copying the contents into server, setting the work directory, doing npm install, and our container is now built. So now what I do is I do sudo docker run, map the port 49160. It could be any port, it's just the local port that I'm going to use, to port 8080, which is the one that I opened up on the server. I want to run it in daemon mode, so it carries on running, and I want to run the container called server. So there we go, it's running. And I can show you it's running by doing docker ps, which is tells me which processes are running. And I can see that that server, that container is now running. And I can curl that container on port 49160. And you'll see there's the response that we expected. It's the same response as earlier on. So now I can do some pretty cool stuff with that. I can start multiple images. So if I go back to my run command and I just run this. Actually, that's not going to work, sorry, because the port's already allocated. What I need to do for this demonstration is remove the local port that I want to use and allow Docker to decide. So I'm going to do that again. I'm just going to start a whole bunch of servers and let Docker decide which port to use. Let's see how fast those things are starting up. If I go to sudo docker ps, I can see how many machines I've got running on my machine on here now, how many containers I've got running.
Yeah, machines,
cool.
Yeah.
I just invented machines.
Yeah. You've got containers, right?
So, I have containers.
So to
right.
kind of, I mean, so for those of you who may not be familiar with the Linux world, curl is a way to actually, it's kind of like a way to do a HTTP request, right? So because the app that Ross built earlier shows you just the response to a basic web query, right? So that is the app, right? So he's now running that many instances of the app, which happens to be inside of that container. So, just to kind of hash in a different way here on what you
absolutely. Yeah. And if we cut back to the screen while you were talking there, I ran another another command called a different command on the server, and I'll just call it on a different container as well. So you can connect to any of those individual containers. They're all running independently. Now, what you would likely do, since these are all front ends, put a load balancer in front. And of course, we can have a container that's a load balancer and simulate a real world environment right here on my dev machine. But better still, because that whole configuration and that whole setup is just in the one Docker file that we had earlier on, that can now go in version control.
Oh.
So all of those steps that we had of setting this machine up and configuring it, et cetera, that's a bonus we get from using this approach, that we can have our configuration in version control like that. So that's really a one more thing, actually. There's always one more thing. So if I go back to my source code, and I forget the name. Oh, I've got to go in the source directory, that's why. Okay, and I edit my source code. Let's just put in here, hi, MVA. Okay, and save that file, and now go back. Let's do a Docker build. Sudo docker build minus tag server. Now, I'm going to rebuild, oops. I got a little typo in the end there. Let me do that again. Oh, sorry, it shouldn't be server. It should be the current directory. There we go. So now we don't have to pull down the client. You see, we've already done for node, et cetera. And the rebuild is extremely quick, which is the point that I wanted to show you. And if I deploy a new one, a new image, let's put it on a port that we know. Let's put it on 8080. Actually, not 8080, I'm going to use that later. Let's put it on 1234. Okay, and now I do a curl against that container. We can see it says hi MVA over here. So we've just completely rebuilt the environment and redeployed it in a matter of seconds. And of course, think about that in A-B testing. I have both of them running here at the moment. All of the older machines are still there. Older containers, sorry. I'm going to keep doing it now.
That's okay.
Containers are still there. So we can do A-B testing now on our machine. There's all sorts of things that we can do, and we can keep doing this kind of thing as we go forward. And I'm going to show you even more powerful stuff in later demos. But for now, how about, I think, Vagrant were we going to talk
about?
Yeah,
I think Vagrant. Yeah, Vagrant's next.
I think
it's good to point out to the Docker Hub, right? Because I think you mentioned Docker files.
Well, I did talk about the Docker Hub. It might be worth just pulling it up in a browser so we can see what it's like, if that's what you're thinking.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Looks like I have to sign in.
Oh, well, you carry on talking about Vagrant. If you want, you can come back.
Yeah, maybe you'll come back to you, and so you can just show what that looks like there. So just to kind of recap here, we have now this an option per Docker, right? We have a configuration as code. We have the Docker file. We have the way, as you can see, to quickly provision in the same manner that application. so let's kind of move now to Vagrant while he pulls that up and do that transition here. So.
No, you finish the Vagrant. Okay, cool. I'll do this.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
The start
right
of
on.
Next
bit. Okay, let's go. So, Vagrant. What is the scenario here? Well, we have we like Chain. she's our development lead.
Cool.
Yeah. she wants to have a she has a solution to have Vagrant provision her VMs and public to configure the application on top, right? So she wants a reproducible environment, hence this section, that she can share and reproduce with different folks inside of her organization. Well, what does it do? The first thing that how it works is you're going to have, you know, create some form of Vagrant file, you know, and when you create that Vagrant file, it has a definition of that underlying virtual machine there. Now, the Vagrant is going to have quite a few different providers. So if you look at, you go to number two there in the visually, you see that we have Hyper-V and Microsoft Azure. Those are both plugins or providers for Vagrant to say, hey, I want my virtual machine to look like this, and I want to provision it in with the Hyper-V provider, right? So then you're going to have a Hyper-V virtual machine with that configuration. Or I want that virtual machine to run in Microsoft Azure with this configuration. Great. So it goes and does that, creates that virtual machine, as you can see, number three. And then after that, though, you're going to want some way to provision the application on top of that, right? Because the Vagrant is only to this point really giving you that base installation of the operating system for the virtual machine. Now you need to get your app running on top of it, and there's a number of plugins or ways to automate that here. So you see Chef, Puppet, you've got the containers, Docker type story there, right? And so you've got a number of ways to try and provision that application on top of it. And then finally, of course, you could, you know, if it's a Linux machine, you could SSH or you could RDP or whatever, right? Because it's a virtual machine, just depends on how you want to access that. So why might you do this? Well, right, I mean, it's going to be a layer of abstraction from that host, right? So you've got a common way to define now your full virtual machine. You've got a way to set up the automate the development and test environment, and you've got that consistency. The other thing, too, I think that's important to point out here is that you've got abstraction. So with Docker, with Vagrant, you've got a way to standardize things that's not specific to any one provider. All right, so if you're thinking about moving this thing to different places from Hyper-V or to Azure or to maybe outside of Microsoft properties, right, you've now got a way that's kind of a standard definition to do those things. So the URL down below gives you more details about the Vagrant project. This next slide gives you idea of kind of how you would do a Vagrant definition, right? You'd initialize Vagrant with, in this case, an Ubuntu underlying operating system. When you say Vagrant up and choose the provider, that would create an Ubuntu Vagrant image now on Hyper-V, and then you'd be able to then SSH into that Vagrant machine. And do what you need to do to do different configurations.
Yeah, and just as with the Docker file as an equivalent of a Vagrant file, and in that Vagrant file you could say, well, I need you to install these packages, I need you to do these things. So when you do that Vagrant up, it does that as well. It will configure it appropriately.
Yep. Okay, so you know, there's a couple links here that are worth calling out as far as how you do that next step of after you've got the base, you know, image configured and you want to install the app, or configure that in a different way. Of course, you could use Puppet and Chef. We've got some ways to highlight how you might do that there.
Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about those later on.
Okay.
As well.
Okay. And then also, it's important to note that, you know, it's as simple if you want to change from Hyper-V to Azure. It's as literally a switch here, right? Earlier, you saw the slide --- provider Hyper-V. If you change the --- provider to Azure, you've now got that same image now provisioned in Azure. So it's pretty cool, pretty powerful thing when you have that common definition.
Right.
Other thing I should point out, because we're talking about how do you, you know, what do you do after, right? So you, if you want a way to kind of share this out, of course you could check it into source code repository, but there is another way that you can kind of collaborate and share on things, and that is there's an option for Vagrant Cloud. Vagrant Cloud is kind of a way to submit your Vagrant files, right, to how to what's provisioned, what's configured. You can share those with the broader community and enable distribution amongst a number of other folks. Today there are providers with Hyper-V images that are there. So, you know, if you're using Hyper-V, there's ways for you to search and find various images submitted from the community that will run on Hyper-V. Maybe this is a good time because it's a relevant topic to talk about Docker Hub if you haven't.
Yeah, sure, we can do it. I have it up here, so we can look at that. So this is really the same kind of concept as Vagrant Crowd. And this is the Docker Hub. And if I just do a search for Node, since that was the image that we were using earlier on, you'll find that there's a whole bunch of images here that have been maintained by people, lots of different images. There's one here with Strongloop pre-installed on there. But I was just using the base Node instance, which is this one here. And I can go in there. It has all sorts of metadata, et cetera. And I can look at all sorts of information about how this works. And this is how you discover the images that you want to base your image on. Same concept as the Vagrant Cloud. You can do the same thing. You go in there and find similar pre-configured machines in Vagrant Cloud.
Yep. Yeah, and then you would, you know, with the Docker Hub, I know you also have the ability to have a private registry as well. So if you want to have a private, just, you know, listing for maybe my team or something like
that. That's right. Yeah, it's free for, if it's a community image and you're sharing it, it's free. You can have one private image for free. You want more than that, you pay for it.
Yep. Makes sense. Okay, so let's shift now to another topic called Packer. So Packer is a tool for also helping with a similar kind of concept. Interestingly enough, this was created by the same guy who worked on Vagrant. So two tools, and part of the way I understand it is that, you know, he created this because Vagrant, he wanted the ability to have an even more independent mechanism, you know, for the templates to actually make the definition for Vagrant.
Yeah.
So kind of a higher layer of abstraction beyond what Vagrant provides in a standardized format. In this case, they utilize JSON in this what they call templates to help have those definitions.
He wanted to extend the idea of a Vagrant file to be able to build the same machine on multiple different providers with just a single command. And that's what that does. So Vagrant will fire you up a single machine on a particular provider, whereas Packer focuses on building you multiple machines from multiple providers. It's a tool for building those kinds of images.
Yeah. So it helps, right, it really helps with that interoperability between those. So I mentioned earlier, Vagrant has the ability to change the provider, but there are some stipulations right there in the way you write those files, whereas Packer is actually providing an additional layer of abstraction to kind of help you make portability a bit more easy. To kind of give you an idea just of the flow that they have here, if you go to the slide, you know, it starts with a template definition, which is a kind of standardized JSON type of language that they have. From there, you choose what they call a builder. The builder is what actually does the building of the image based on the provider that you select. You know, we mentioned there Amazon, Azure, Docker, Google Compute, OpenStack, VMware. After you've got that kind of base image on the provider, then you're going to need to do some form of post-processing, whether that be a Docker, using even the interesting combination of Vagrant, maybe you have a Vagrant on top of the Packer thing. It might be that you also do, you know, the next step of provisioners, right? Where, again, similar to the Vagrant concept where you have an application configuration on top of that, you might also have the provisioner go and automatically install a Chef agent, automatically install a Puppet agent, have that agent then go do further configuration for that particular base virtual machine image that's being created. And at the end, right, you've got this build. The build is the end deliverable VM that's now been automated and provisioned through this whole process that you have the ability to access. So kind of that's a really cram course on Packer. the thing that's a little tricky here is if you go to the Packer site and you look at the different the different builders that you see there, today there's not really an obvious, well, where's Hyper-V, where's Azure? And so there actually is integration. If you go to the slide here, there's two links that are from the MS OpenTech team for Packer Hyper-V, Packer Azure, to help you to provision that.
These are plugins and into Packer itself, and we'll be moving those over into the core Packer code as appropriate when the community have verified the work that we've done is of suitable standard, which it is. It just, they need
just
to do
wait.
Their testing.
Okay, yeah, okay, good to know. Maybe by the time you're watching this, that'll have already been done, but hey, there
well,
we go.
Yeah, we got to ask them to do it, yeah.
So, we got to ask them to do it.
They're not holding on them.
Okay, cool. Okay, so then, just to kind of, I guess, recap things, right? So, you really need to focus and think about your app architecture, right? Before you start just heads down, we're going Docker, or we're going Azure IaaS, or we're going, you know, Azure PaaS. Like, you gotta, or the tools that you use underneath that, you gotta think about what is makes the most sense for your business and the trade-offs between each of those underlying architectures, right? If you're gonna do Docker, you know, how are you gonna make that highly available if the host OS goes down? You gotta think about these types of things before you'd make that decision to go down that path. Nonetheless, we've given you a lot of different ideas on how to make a reproducible environment with that core foundation of infrastructure configuration as code can surface itself, as you see, in a lot of different ways, whether it's a Docker file, whether it's a Vagrant provider file, or a Docker.io template, or a PowerShell script, or a, you know, whatever it is. The main thing is you've got a consistent way in code to provision the infrastructure and the application on top of it that's reproducible in throughout your environment.
Yeah, and that configuration is stored in exactly the same place as the source code, and that's key. We started off talking about how we need to create communication points mm-hmm. between the various different people in this, and this is one of the communication points. Now we have everything all in the same place. Everybody works in the same version control. We can all see the changes that are going in and out. We all understand what's happening. So we're increasing the amount of communication. And so we don't get to that picture that we had earlier on. So, hey, I need 5 new features. Yeah. Because they've seen those new features going into the code. They've seen the changes that are going into the configuration files. They know it's coming down the line. Yeah. They can be thinking about it before the deadline is put on the table.
Yeah, and as you know, that maybe the application requirements change, guess what? You've got that infrastructure configuration as code right on the same repo in the same location, so that if there's changes there, that way you know it's locked in step, so that whatever happens, you're going to have consistency and reliability to know that that thing is going to do what it should be doing. And if it doesn't, guess what? Everybody has access to the same thing, and they know that it's broken, and they can look at the changes of what happened to try and fix and remediate things. Okay, so to kind of also, you know, summarize where we're at, though, you know, we've talked about process tools, we've talked about source control, we've also talked about infrastructure as code and ways to kind of automate that provisioning, but it really, so far, is somebody manually, let's say, executing a script to make all that happen, right? So there's a lot of challenges in how do you automate things, right? If you're going to do 50 deploys a day, you're not going to have some guy clicking, you know, provision the infrastructure there, right? Also, we haven't talked at all about testing, which is what we'll talk about next here. So stay tuned and continue on with this jumpstart after the break.